Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. Renowned as a printer, scientist, and diplomat, Benjamin Franklin also published more works on religious topics than any other 18th century American layperson. As Thomas Kidd reveals in Benjamin Franklin, The Religious Life of a Founding Father, published by Yale University Press in 2018, Franklin's attitude towards religion was far more complex than is often assumed. Thomas Kidd is research professor of church history at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, and a senior research scholar at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. I'm so glad his new book has brought him to our program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Sure. Well, most of my writing thus far has been on religion and the colonial and revolutionary period of American history. I've sort of gone back and forth between writing about the Great Awakening, a series of revivals in America in the 1740s, and then the American Revolutionary period, which is 30 years later in 1770s and 80s. And in America, there's really few historical topics that are as politically controversial as the role of religion in the American founding. And there's lots of discussion in American politics and on social media about, is America founded as a Christian nation? And, you know, were the founding fathers Christians or were they atheists and agnostics? And I think that Franklin is a especially good case study about this because, you know, Franklin said that he was a deist in his autobiography. So that's a pretty good place to start about thinking about Franklin's religious commitments. But he also grew up in a very traditional Puritan family in Boston. And so in Franklin's person, I think you have that kind of tension between traditional religion and then skepticism that influences at least a number of the major founding fathers in America. And so I was just fascinated by trying to map out what exactly Franklin's religious influences and why he was so interested in religion and theology, as you said, that he ends up publishing probably more as an author on religious topics than any other non-minister in 18th century America. So he was deeply committed to this topic, even though he said he was a deist. And so I thought that was worth investigating.
Right. And so your book, in a sense, is coming to kind of correct the historical perception of Franklin, or at least the common perception of Franklin. Before we correct it, what is the common perception regarding Franklin's religious faith?
Well, I think some of it is certainly guided by what he says about his own faith or lack thereof in the autobiography. The autobiography of Ben Franklin is one of the best-selling books in American history and has an enormous global readership for sure. And there he tells a story about growing up in this devout Puritan family in Boston. But he is a voracious reader. And so especially as a teenager, he begins to read sometimes at his own father's suggestion. His father, of course, is very devout in trying to get him to be a traditional Christian, but his father even gives him some deistic writings that are at least written against traditional Christian belief. And Franklin, ends up thinking that the deist argument is more persuasive. And so there is, I think, from people who come at it from that angle, there's a perception that this is sort of just a classic story, which in some ways is true about Franklin, that person who grows up in a devout family and then gets exposed to more skeptical writings becomes a skeptic or a deist himself, in Franklin's case. But I think that Franklin, I mean, as you would expect, the autobiography is very stylized and it leaves out a lot of important things. But even within the autobiography, you find out, for instance, that Franklin is very close with the most important evangelical revivalist and evangelist in the 18th century, George Whitefield, who is the leading preacher of the Great Awakening in the mid-1800s in Britain and America. And so it just kind of raises the question, like, what sort of deist is longtime friends with the most important preacher of the mid-18th century, and why did they have that friendship? So there's a lot more to the story, I think, than just the simple, Puritan boy reads skeptical writings and then sort of loses his faith.
Right. And so you mentioned that Franklin grew up in a Puritan family. For listeners who are not familiar, could you tell us a little bit about Puritan religion and how, well, let's start with that.
Sure. So the New England colonies, Massachusetts and Connecticut in particular, are founded by the English Puritans who are part of the English Reformation, the Protestant movement, but they're very strong on Reformation doctrine and are critical of the established Church of England, which is the official church of England at the time and still is today, that they do not think that the Church of England is sufficiently reformed in alignment with biblical models about the way the church should run. And also they are Calvinist theologically, so they believe in things like predestination as far as God has predestined the people who are going to be saved to salvation and left everyone else to their own devices, which basically means going to hell. And so they're very intense Protestants among the English, and so part of their dissatisfaction with the church situation in England leads a group of the Puritans to found Massachusetts and Connecticut and to commit those colonies to what they saw as biblical true Christianity. And that leaves a very deep imprint on the New England colonies and then later states. And so Franklin's parents come to Massachusetts in the 1670s as Puritan settlers, and they're believed certainly in the religious mission of those colonies. And so that's the environment in which Franklin grows up. It is it's intense, deeply committed. They're going to church twice a week and hearing very lengthy, deeply theological sermons. And so one of the effects that this has on Franklin is that he knows the Bible, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. He knows the English text of the King James Version backwards and forwards. He has much of it committed to memory, and it shapes the way that he thinks and writes and talks. And Franklin was a great conversationalist, and so when he's telling stories and all this, I mean, it's often with reference to the Bible. And so probably among the major founders, Ben Franklin knows the Bible itself, the text of the Bible, the best among I would say the major founders, and that's because of his Puritan background.
Right. And how tolerant was the Puritan church and the Puritan colonies towards religious diversity at the time?
Not tolerant. Of course, there's not very many groups, Christian groups at the time, that were tolerant of religious difference. This is one of the reasons why John Locke's writings on religion in the 1690s are path-breaking in the way that they are, is that Locke and people like him begin to propose that, we don't have to persecute people, because of religious differences, although Locke thinks that the limits of toleration end at the limits of Protestantism. He doesn't think that Protestants should tolerate Catholics, but still, Catholics didn't tolerate Protestants at the time, and Protestants didn't tolerate Catholics, and different kinds of Protestants were unacceptable. And so in Massachusetts, for instance, until the Glorious Revolution, which happens in Massachusetts in 1689, they banned, the Puritans banned basically all other kinds of Protestant groups and Catholics and Jews. So their limits of toleration are very narrow. I do think that the Puritans probably are stereotyped as being uniquely intolerant. I don't think that that's true. But Franklin certainly grows up in an environment where religious difference was not viewed very kindly.
Right. And you mentioned that Franklin was an avid reader of the Bible. What other books did Franklin read in his youth, and what impact did they have on his religious outlook?
Well, Franklin was a very bright boy and voracious reader. And so in some ways he would just read whatever he could get his hands on and virtually any topic, but that certainly included religion. Like so many children at that time, he read John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress, which, speaking of best-selling books in world history, that's another one. And it's an allegory of the Christian's progress to heaven. But very compelling for a boy like Franklin. And he referred back to Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress many times in his adulthood in a very admiring way. Bunyan was a type of Puritan too. But Franklin loved reading Bunyan but anything you can imagine, Franklin is reading. And so this is partly why he's reading anti-deistic writers as a teenager, and then he's reading deist writers. And you can see that he's really on a search to, and this is a sort of classic move of people who grow up in religiously devout families, that, maybe in your teens or in college or something like that. No, Franklin has almost no formal education at all. But he's reading lots and lots of things. And you can see that in his teen years, he's trying to discover, well, what do I believe about Christianity myself? And he comes to very different conclusions than what his parents believe and what some of his siblings who remain devout traditional Christians believe. And his parents are pretty concerned about him and are praying for him to come back. And he... I think as an older adult, does gravitate somewhat back towards his parents' sort of traditional Calvinist Puritan faith, but he never gets back, certainly, to being a fully traditional Christian himself.
Right. And you note that early on in his life, Franklin embraced deism. What exactly does deism consist of?
Well, deism can mean a lot of different things in 18th century America and Britain. The term is discussed really more than probably that there are actual atheists or deists. And in that way, it's similar to atheism, which is a term that's used a lot in the 18th century and much more than there are actual atheists. But there are larger numbers of deists and self-described deists in the 18th century. But that term can mean a wide range of theological beliefs and convictions. Today, we tend to think of deism as the belief in kind of the clockmaker God is the stereotypical meaning of this, that you have people who believe that God is still the creator, but that God is not involved anymore in human history and human affairs. So that God, like the clockmaker, the cosmic clockmaker, has created the world and created humankind, but now is kind of off doing something else, and God is not involved anymore. Maybe God sort of lost interest in what people are doing or something, but he's not involved anymore in our lives. I don't think, though, that that's Franklin's brand of deism so much. I think that Franklin, especially after he goes through a pretty skeptical, a deeply, intensely skeptical phase as a young man, but from the time he comes back to America, he goes to England for a while in his late teens, early 20s. But when he comes back to America and he's around his relatives who tend to be more traditional Christians, I think that Franklin sort of resolves to be more of a what we might call a kind of ethical Christian, in the sense that he believes that Jesus's ethics are very important and valid, but he's not really that interested anymore in doctrinal debates about Christianity. And so Franklin, I think from that point forward, is okay with the idea that God is providentially involved in human history and including in the events that are leading up eventually to the founding of the United States. I think Franklin is pretty comfortable with the idea that God is involved somehow. Though he's less certain that people can always tell what God is doing. And so Franklin is given to kind of making jokes about how people always think God is on their side in politics or in war or something like that, but that, God can't possibly be on sort of everybody's side at the same time. And so he'll kind of joke about that, about how silly it is to always be saying that God has led you to win the battle because, you're as likely to lose the battle the next time. But I think that Franklin still is basically a providentialist in thinking, especially as he gets into the depths of the American Revolution and all the amazing things that are happening to him and his colleagues in the American Revolution. I think he would readily concede that God must be doing something to be behind the founding of the United States. I mean, how could he not be? I mean, this is so amazing. What's happening in the independent United States is so improbable that he thinks, well, God has to be behind this somehow.
Right. And who is Mrs. Silence Dugood, and how did she get her name?
So Franklin, in his early writing, is often taking on pen names, and Silence Dugood is one of his pen names when he's writing in his early writing career, and it's a pen name that he uses to criticize the pastors in Massachusetts for their religious hypocrisy and so forth. And it is interesting that he takes on a woman's name that almost, the founding fathers are all the time writing under pen names, but it's virtually always as male pen names. So it's pretty interesting that he takes on, I think, to sort of signal his humility as an anonymous author writing under a pen name. It is a sort of take off on some things that Cotton Mather, who is the leading minister in Boston at the time when Franklin is writing, and somebody that Franklin knows personally, had written a pamphlet called Essays to Do Good. And so Franklin is sort of lampooning that kind of Puritan, late Puritan ethos of always, you know, looking for ways as a Christian to do good. And usually Franklin thought that that probably led people to get involved in messing with, you know, being a busybody and messing with other people's lives.
Right. And what was the Junto or the Leather Apron Club, and what vision of religion did Franklin propose to that body?
Sure. Well, this was a early group that he founded of sort of artisans in Philadelphia. And there were lots of social clubs being founded at that time as part of the Enlightenment, that there was a sense that they needed some kind of social outlet that was not church-based. And of course, one of the functions that church always plays for people or other kinds of religious congregations place for people is a social outlet. But Franklin was concerned that for people outside of the church and outside of college, and Franklin never went to college, that there needed to be some place to discuss religious ideas with like-minded people and other kinds of philosophical and scientific topics. Of course, Franklin has enormously wide-ranging interests, famously in science. But as I'm showing in the book, also in religion. And so they're trying to discuss things, I think, in religion that you couldn't really safely discuss in church settings, because they're basically just discussing, you know, issues about how do you know that God exists, and what does God require of us, and those kind of things that he felt like in a denominational, say a Presbyterian kind of context, which is more dominant in Philadelphia, that you just wouldn't be able to safely discuss these kinds of things. So it's a little more, you know, you wouldn't necessarily call it overtly skeptical and hostile to religion, but you're probably discussing things with young men that he knows who are artisans. And Franklin by that time is in the print business. That he feels like you'll be able to discuss in the junto that you wouldn't be able to discuss in a more denominational environment.
Right. And did Franklin write in support of polytheism?
So this is confusing because Franklin writes things that can be hard to understand. I mean, he writes so much about theology as a young man, and some of it is very speculative. And so there's one thing that he writes in those early years in particular, where he talks about the theory that that all the different religions of the world somehow may reflect a sort of shadow or an approximation of the one true God, but that we can't really know that God. And so that the supreme God maybe creates sort of sub deities that, you know, so Jesus and Muhammad and so forth that we can know and are more like us, that allows us somehow to sort of approach some knowledge of the ultimate divine. And there are other times when Franklin will talk about the gods doing things, although the Bible occasionally speaks about the gods too. So the, you know, he may just be drawing on the scripture there, but he doesn't really follow these ideas up. It's more Franklin's temperament is to be speculating about, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And he often will raise these kind of ideas that sound, for instance, polytheistic, but it's much harder to pin Franklin down on anything that's sort of a lifelong conviction along these lines. So I would say he proposes, you know, what would it be like if there was a sort of polytheistic order, but I don't think he's very committed to the idea.
Right. Well, speaking of things that Franklin wrote, religious things that he may really have been committed to, did Franklin create his own prayers?
Yes, I mean he was always interested in sort of guides to personal devotion, and so he would write his own prayers and things that seem to, and Jefferson is this way too, that for people who are pretty skeptical about traditional religion, they seem interested in having sort of substitute, not just intellectual systems, but ways of personal devotion. And so, Franklin would sort of capture snippets of things that he found inspiring in other writers, and write his own prayers and so forth. And he's a dabbler. I mean, he thinks that if you sample this way in the kind of the greatest hits of mostly in the Christian tradition, that you'll come into something like a truer system of religion, but that tradition sort of paralyzes people and doesn't lead to true devotion as he saw it.
All right. Could you give us a little flavor of what one of these prayers from Franklin was like?
Let's see. I'm going to have to write. As you remember, this book came out 5 years ago. Do you have a suggestion on which one you would?
That's a good question. I like them all. I was really taken. Just as you were saying, by the idea that someone who doesn't seem to fall into kind of the traditional, very maybe literal, sort of pious model that we might think of for a Christian person, for someone like that to then write their own prayers, I just found that fascinating. And I think, as you said, this idea of people who are not quite sort of typical Christians, but who want not only, as you said, the kind of intellectual, stimulation or foundation or whatever that faith might be able to provide, but even some of the trappings of a religious practice, like a prayer, something that you might think, well, of course, if people were more secular minded, scientific minded, whatever, well, obviously they would abandon things like prayers. For him not only to embrace it, but for him to actually create his own, I think is really just a fascinating thing.
Yeah. And I think that one of the points I'm trying to make in the book is that a lot of this, I do think it's sincere, but it's also, he knows that his parents, and then later on, his sister, Jane Mecham, who is an evangelical Christian, are worried about him. It's sincere. They're not just, busybodies or something. I mean, they really are concerned about his eternal fate. And I think some of this is him wanting, it's sincere on his part too, but he's wanting them to be reassured that he's okay, that he has a version of Christianity that he's devoted to, and that they don't need to worry about him. And so if he, and I, again, I think there's something like this going on with Jefferson too, that if they have their own system of devotion and prayers and so forth, that they can tell concerned friends or family members that, well, I pray too. And in Franklin's case, I even write my own prayers but it's very individualistic. The kind of religion that they are practicing. And so in Franklin and Jefferson's case, I mean, if we take them at their word, they do seem to pray a lot, which is a different, as you said, is kind of a different version of, kind of their skeptical lives than we would naturally assume.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot with the prayer. If there's one that you know comes to mind, that's fine. That'd be great for you to share. But if not, then we have other things to delve into. All right. So maybe we'll move on. people could certainly read the book and see some explicit quotes from these prayers. Okay, so speaking of kind of alternative outlets, so to speak, for religion or communal feeling, Franklin got involved in the Freemason movement. What was it about Freemasonry that appealed to Franklin?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of the founding fathers who are involved with Freemasonry, and you know, critics of the Freemasonry and the founding fathers would say virtually all of them were Freemasons, which I don't think is true. But Franklin definitely was a Freemason, and he was instrumental in introducing Freemasonry into the American colonies. And then the United States, and this is it is kind of an enlightened religion. There's definitely a lot of Christian content in it, but it styles itself as being a religion of rationality and learning and science, and devotion too. That is fit for the men, especially of an enlightened age, it attracts people like Voltaire in France, for instance, and Franklin is affiliated with Voltaire's lodge for a little while when Franklin is in Paris, it's an international religion. It's cosmopolitan, up to date with kind of the most current learning and so forth. And so for someone like Franklin, I think that Freemasonry is a good example. I mean, I don't know that he is ever that committed of a Freemason. I think, somebody like Washington may be more committed to it. But he sees it, I think, as a really great alternative for someone who doesn't want to reject religion altogether, but wants to have a kind of anti-traditional kind of religion, someone who sees traditional Christianity as sometimes kind of anti-intellectual, anti-learning, whether that's fair or not. Franklin, I think, tends to see traditional Christianity that way, and so Freemasonry gives him an alternative, but it's also, in some ways, like the Junto. It's a social outlet for men who style themselves as being enlightened, to be able to talk about philosophical issues and learning, and religion and devotion to God, in a more flexible kind of, pro learning, this kind of thing. So, and would be less dogmatic. And so that's, I think, what attracts him to Freemasonry, but I'm also mindful that, you know, Franklin, you know, everywhere is kind of thinking, he's very speculative, as I said, about religion. So he's always talking about kind of new social outlets, new opportunities, new ways to organize people that is kind of moving past traditional church structures. And so I don't get the sense that Franklin is ever that interested in sort of the details of Freemason doctrine, of which there is some, but he's definitely interested in Freemasonry as a kind of social structure for people like him.
Right. And Franklin focused on living an ethical life and helping others. I mean, that clearly comes through in a lot of his writing. How did he feel about slavery?
Well, Franklin, a lot of people don't know that Franklin owned slaves for much of his adult life. Now, he was not invested in slavery the way that, say, Thomas Jefferson was. The Southern founders tended overall, as you would expect, to have a deeper structural investment and financial investment in enslaved people as part of their personal fortune. And so Franklin was not that way, although we do think that he made a good amount of money off of selling ads in the Pennsylvania Gazette about runaway slaves. Colonial American newspapers were full of ads about people trying to track down slaves who had run away from captivity. And Franklin sold a lot of ads as the editor of the Pennsylvania Gazette. So it's not just his slave owning that leads him to be complicit in American slavery, but runaway slave ads. He would run ads in his newspaper for the sale of enslaved people. And some of the language he used in the newspaper sometimes suggested that he may have been involved in slave trafficking himself, because he would run ads that would say, you know, such and such Negroes for sale, inquire at the offices of the Pennsylvania Gazette. But we don't know for sure whether he actually was personally involved in selling slaves. If he was, then he was deeply, deeply involved in the slave trade. But late in life, he started to be exposed more and more to anti-slavery activists in Philadelphia. And he found their arguments to be persuasive. And so he divested himself of all of his slaves. He never had an enormous number of slaves that he personally owned, but he did have some. And so by the time of the Revolution, he had largely divested himself of all of his, you know, slaves either that he owned or rented out to other people. And so after the Revolution is over, he gets involved in the early American anti-slavery movement as, you know, maybe a way of sort of atoning for his past involvement with slavery. And certainly there's no reason to doubt the sincerity of his anti-slavery convictions, although, you know, you do wonder, he doesn't seem understandably to want to talk about the fact that he himself spent more of his life as a slave owner and involved in at least advertising slave trafficking than he did late in life as an anti-slavery writer. But it is true that he concludes his life, unlike most of the major founders, he concludes his life having enlisted in an anti-slavery cause, which is something that certainly the Southern founders would never have done. So he ends his life, and from a modern perspective, kind of having come over to the ethically correct position.
Right. And you mentioned previously that Franklin had a close relationship with George Whitefield, a preacher and founder of the evangelical movement. What was the nature of his relationship with Whitefield?
So George Whitefield was arguably the most famous person in America in the 1740s. He's in terms of name recognition, probably more people knew the name of the King of England, the success of King George's in those decades. But definitely more people had heard Whitefield preach or had read something by Whitefield than any person in America. And of course, most of the American colonists had never seen the King of England in person. And so Whitefield is from England, but he makes 7 trips to the American colonies during his lifetime. And especially in the early 1740s, just takes America by storm. Enormously popular preacher and writer and his sermons. And he has very popular travel journals, Whitefield does. And so when Franklin starts hearing about Whitefield in the late 1730s, by that point, Franklin is running the Pennsylvania Gazette, and Franklin is skeptical about the reported crowd numbers, because the English newspapers are reporting that tens of thousands of people are coming to hear Whitefield preach in London in particular. I mean, there were reports in the late 1730s of Whitefield attracting crowds as large as 80,000 people. And of course, this is in a pre-amplification age, pre-electricity. Franklin is working on that, but they haven't developed it yet. And so Whitefield doesn't have microphones, but still, certainly there have to be crowds as large as maybe 20,000 people coming to see him at one time. And Franklin is intrigued, but skeptical. And so when Whitefield comes to Philadelphia as part of his preaching tour in America, Whitefield is needing to tap into the printing networks in America. And so Whitefield basically says, tell me who's the best media man in Philadelphia, and people direct him to Franklin, in spite of the fact that Franklin is a religious skeptic. And so they strike up this business relationship where Franklin begins printing most of Whitefield's major works. And Franklin ends up making a phenomenal amount of money off of selling Whitefield's imprints. And Whitefield totally transforms the whole print market in America. We think that between about 1738 and 1741, the total print output in America basically doubles. And the whole doubling is almost all because of Whitefield. So Franklin sees this, and he knows, I can make a ton of money off of this guy. And he does. But Franklin not only is printing Whitefield's materials, but he prints anti-Whitefield materials too. And Whitefield's fine with that. I mean, Whitefield has no problem, because he knows, controversy will just attract more attention to my preaching, and that's fine. And so he doesn't put any kind of constraints on Franklin about what he can and can't publish. So this is, in all seriousness, I mean, this is part of the reason why Franklin is able to retire early from printing and has become independently wealthy, is because of his relationship with Whitefield. So it starts as a business relationship that's very congenial for both of them, because Franklin does a great job distributing and selling Whitefield's materials, and then Franklin makes a lot of money for himself doing this. But in time, I think they become pretty close friends. It's a wonderful relationship, I think, because they both are so clear about their religious differences. And Whitefield, as is Whitefield's wont, I mean, he pulls no punches about telling Franklin that you need to believe in Jesus for salvation, you need to be born again, and you're not, you're not okay religiously. And Franklin responds and says, well, I think I am okay. And I'm not sure that I do need to be born again. And I think I'm fine. But what's so special about it is that they're able to have a friendship that I think it really is a close friendship, though they don't see each other that often because Whitefield is constantly traveling. But they sort of, I think they kind of understand each other, especially once Franklin becomes a celebrity. Franklin's celebrity comes about 10 years after Whitfield's. And Franklin is never as famous in his own time as Whitfield is in his. But I think that they kind of understand the common experience of being celebrities, and having, you know, lots and lots of people who are sort of seeking their time and attention. But they never sort of give up on the idea that they can speak very frankly to one another about their religious differences. And I think in that sense, it's a friendship that would be rare in their time, but even more rare today, that you would have people who have such distinct religious differences who also remain pretty close friends.
Indeed. did Franklin use the Bible to promote militias in the 1740s?
He did. One of Franklin's most earliest political writings was an argument, it was a pamphlet called Plain Truth, where he was making an argument for Pennsylvania to have a militia that would be ready to call on in case of invasion by the French or the Spanish. And this was a live possibility that the colonies were almost always either at war or at risk of war with the Catholic powers of France and Spain. And Franklin was frustrated that that Pennsylvania, because it was controlled politically and religiously by the Quakers, who were pacifists, that they were unwilling to have a colonial militia to call on in the case of invasion. And so Franklin was not a pacifist, and he thought that there was actually a Christian argument for defense of the colony. And so he made a Christian, but also just a biblical argument for why he thought this was right. And so he actually, one of the main arguments that he made to most modern readers would be totally obscure. I think it's in the book of Judges, chapter 19, about something about some priests and the expedition of the Danites in Israel and stuff. But it tells you, first of all, what a deeply informed biblical reader that Franklin is himself. But, it's hard for us today, even for someone like me. I mean, I read the Bible regularly, too, for devotional purposes. But I have to admit, that one went right over my head. I mean, I thought the expedition, the Danites, and what are you talking about? But to Franklin, this is a popular pamphlet, and he assumed that most of his readers would know that reference, or at least had heard of it. And it tells you what a deeply biblicist culture that Franklin is writing into. And Franklin is in himself as a pamphleteer is perfectly capable of writing for that culture, because he knows as much about the Bible as anyone in his audience. So that I think is important to remember about Franklin, that skeptic though he was not just marginally familiar with the Bible. He knew the text very comprehensively and was capable of calling on it in not just theological writing, but also political writing.
All right. And as you write in the book, I mean, and as people know about Franklin, he was a very popular writer. I mean, he was someone who had a very, very keen sense of what his readers would know about. It's hard to imagine, in other words, that he was off the mark here, that he thought, oh yes, everyone would know about this, and then it turned out no one did. Like, he was someone who had a very deep sense of what the average person, the average reader of his material, what they would know, what they would understand. And as you say, if he went to this passage in the Bible, it's clear that his average readers really did understand this, and that this would resonate with them on some level.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's common in the founding period, that when you look at Tom Paine's Common Sense, a really critical portion of that fairly short book is on 1 Samuel 8 about the Israelites asking for a king, and Payne, also a skeptic, writing and drawing on the Bible, Patrick Henry's Liberty or Death speech, very short speech, full of references to the prophet Jeremiah. This is just popular persuasion in the time of the revolution, and that the sort of coin of the realm, as it were, is the Bible itself. And so especially for Franklin, is a very common source of examples and anecdotes and allusions when he's writing in this political persuasion mode.
Right. And you note that Franklin created a checklist of 13 virtues that he felt were important for people's daily life. In what ways were these virtues, his virtues, similar to and also different from Puritan ethics?
Well, I think that they're very similar in the sense of what kinds of virtues, love, frugality, honesty, temperance, these kind of things would be very close to the just traditional Christian ethics, Jewish and Christian ethics. And so I think in that list of virtues, what you see him doing is, again, saying, I can be devout, I can be very concerned with ethics, but not from a traditional Christian perspective. I think that there was a that kind of impulse to, none of the founders would say, we don't need virtue in society. It was just a given. And I think in our way, it's a given today that, the Republic needs people of virtue who will be, neighborly and kind and benevolent and charitable and these kinds of things. But the traditional Christian view was that one has to have a right relationship with God before you can manifest true virtue. And I think that Franklin is, again, experimenting with the idea that if we just focus on the virtues themselves, that you can have a commitment to that that's born out of education or individual conviction or your relationship with God, but that the thing that we need is the virtuous commitment, not some doctrinal belief about God being this or that way according to some denominational tradition. So, but it is interesting to watch Franklin. I mean, he for some periods of his life actually tracked, the way that he complied with that list of virtues. And in that, I think that Franklin is trying to show a certain kind of seriousness about his own virtuous, practices and rituals and behavior, so that he wasn't just speculating about this, but he was trying to actually put it into practice. And I do think that Franklin, by the way, is a very charitable person. I mean, he helps to found the first hospital in Philadelphia. And when he makes the argument for why people should support this, it's one of the most explicitly Christian things that he ever writes, that he makes an argument for charity and hospitality and taking care of the poor and vulnerable as a Christian obligation. He gave a lot of money. I mean, he was independently wealthy and in a position to do that, but he gave a lot of money to charity himself. The one virtue that I'm not sure how closely he tracked it was about his relationship with women. He's known for sort of hobnobbing with the ladies of Paris, and that's true. But he also did not treat his wife very charitably at all. And he basically ignored her for a number of years while she was descending into desperate health problems. And this partly accounts for his estrangement with his son, William, that some of his children just thought he treated his wife in an appalling way.
And I'm curious, is there a relationship between Franklin's proverbs about achieving wealth and religion?
Well, this has been discussed for a century and more, especially because of the work of Max Weber, the German sociologist, that he proposed in his classic thesis about the Protestant work ethic, that there's this sort of, in Franklin, you see almost the epitome of this kind of secularized Protestantism, that the Puritans classically believed that every person has a calling vocationally, and that you honor God through hard work and integrity in business and those kind of, you know, business virtues. And that in the American tradition, there becomes this kind of secularized version of honoring God in your calling, that the God part of it, in Franklin's case, sort of drops out, but the ethics sort of remain the same, and that you see that manifested, among other things, in Franklin's, his Poor Richard, in his almanacs and so forth. That there's another thing that he made a lot of money off of. That he had these, business ethics and about effective use of time and frugality and these sorts of things that you see a kind of secularized Puritanism in that. I might say that I think Franklin wasn't as secular maybe as Weber thought that he was. Because he sure did seem to keep thinking about God and have relationships with traditional Christians, including George Whitefield and his sister Jane Meacom, and so forth. So I think God was still very much on Franklin's mind. But I think Weber is, I'm somewhat sympathetic to this idea that some of the ideas about, and you see it even in today's more secular business literature and self-improvement and that kind of thing, in which Franklin is always a kind of iconic figure in that literature, but a lot of it has almost no explicit reference to God at all. That Weber would have kind of understood that pop business literature as being coming from Franklin in a lot of ways.
All right, and so you mentioned early on that people today, Americans today, are often very interested in the religious beliefs or lack thereof of the founding fathers as a way to kind of position themselves and think about the questions of separation of church and state and so on. So I'm wondering, what was Franklin's attitude regarding the separation of church and state?
Well, Franklin definitely wanted the states and the new United States to not have official denominations, and in some ways that was a natural for him because by the time he was in his teens, Pennsylvania had become his home colony and then home state, and Pennsylvania never had an official denomination. Now the Quakers were dominant, but they did not create a tax-supported what the founders called an establishment of religion, and so in the 1780s in 1770s and 80s when Pennsylvania was framing its new state constitution, he definitely wanted there to be separation of church and state in an official sense. But that never would have meant to Franklin that religion is somehow absent from the public sphere. Franklin himself is constantly, in his speeches at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, he's constantly citing the Bible as he's given to do. And there's a very strange moment at the Constitutional Convention when Franklin asked the delegates to begin sessions with prayer. So again, you have Franklin here. He's, by this point, he's quite elderly. Franklin, the deist and skeptic, is asking the delegates to begin sessions at the convention with prayer, and they're framing the Constitution. And he says, we should be calling on the Father of Lights, which is a biblical phrase, but it's also a kind of enlightened way of talking about God. We should be calling on the Father of Lights for wisdom, and it's foolish for us not to be praying to open sessions. But the motion wasn't adopted. When you hear this in kind of Christian conservative circles, sometimes they'll say that Franklin proposed prayer, but they forget to mention that it's almost more stunning that the convention didn't adopt his motion. They couldn't agree about what chaplain they're going to have and this sort of thing. So they just don't do anything about it, and they don't open sessions with prayer. Franklin in that case is almost making an argument for more presence of God, more presence of prayer in the public sphere. And this is why people like Franklin get sort of picked up by people, say, on the Christian right. They say, Franklin was pushing for there to be prayer in American public life and so forth, but they forget that the convention didn't do anything about his proposal. And Franklin was really kind of angry about the fact that they didn't. I mean, he thought, you all are fools. We should be praying. But not enough delegates thought that was important enough to do something about it.
Right. And did Franklin have an opinion about the government paying the clergy?
Well, he certainly wouldn't have wanted an established church. And one of the things that an established church would have done is to have, the pastors when in the states, colonies and states where the pastors, where they have an established church, the pastors effectively become employees of the state. Franklin would not have wanted that. And so that one of the great divisions of the time of the founding is about whether the state governments in particular should continue to have that kind of established church relationship. But Franklin in general, I think, would not have wanted that.
Right. Well, there's so much more that we could talk about, but we are out of time. So I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.